You're listening to Queers, a podcast about politics and culture with Simon Copland and Benjamin Riley.
That sounded fine from my end.
Cool. Okay, that's the important thing. Okay, let's do it. It's the 11th of January, 2017. I'm Benjamin Riley.
And I'm Simon Copland.
Welcome to Queers. Each week we talk our way through questions on a theme, and this week we are talking about identity politics. But before we get into all that, given it's been a little while, Simon, how was your break?
Yeah, it wasn't too bad. Pretty busy, actually. We, me and my partners moved just before Christmas, and in that period, the three of us one by one got sick. So it was a bit tiring and a bit stressful, but then once that was done and we were moved, we went down to the coast for a few nights, which was really nice, just a bit of a relaxing time, and then came back to Canberra after Christmas and spent some really good days just sort of tidying up our new house and relaxing and catching up with friends. And my partner Martin, his mum is in town, and we've been doing sort of touristy stuff that we haven't done yet, or that you do rarely with her, which has also been really quite nice. Actually, it's been a good excuse to sort of ease back into the year,
like touristy stuff in Canberra.
In Canberra, yeah.
So, I mean, what? Because you've lived there for quite a while.
Yeah, but like I've lived here all my life, but you know, so we went to the National Museum the other day, which I've been to before, but like I haven't been to for quite a while. You know, and things change. We went to the zoo yesterday, which again I've been to ages ago, but I haven't been to for ages. You know, we took the excuse to go down to the river and go swimming over the weekend. Maybe this weekend we might be going to the nature reserve or something like that. So, you know, that kind of stuff that, you know, you live in a place and you don't go to the museum very often because,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
You live in the place. So it's nice to have that excuse to do that. And as I said, it's, you know, sort of easing back into the year of working, and I'm going to have a pretty busy year. So it's a nice excuse to not be like straight into the hitting the grindstone straight away.
Sure.
You know, how about you?
Yeah, I had a really lovely break. Went up to Wodonga, which is where I grew up, to see my parents for Christmas. My partner came up with me, which was really lovely. Just kind of sat around drinking gin and, I don't know, doing very little, which is what Christmas tends to be for us.
Yeah, that sounds lovely.
Yeah, it was really nice. And then just kind of, you know, suffered through the heat a bit in Melbourne in the week between Christmas and New Year's, which is always what happens as well. I hate summer. I just kind of, you know, sit around miserable in a hot house because inevitably nowhere has air conditioning. so that was less fun. But then just had a really lovely New Year's as well. I was saying to someone the other day, I feel like the older I get, the less I hate New Year's, because I'm like just kind of okay with having these quite low key New Year's Eves. So I just went to a friend of mine, has this beautiful garden with her house, and she set up a dinner, and we just kind of sat out, me and a bunch of other people sat out in her garden and ate dinner and drank and, I don't know, rang in the new year.
That sounds really nice. I agree with you. You sort of, when you hit a particular age, I reckon you sort of start to appreciate that New Year's it doesn't have to be this big event every time.
Totally. It's not like, oh my God, where am I going to be at midnight? Like, yeah. I've got to be dancing. I've got to be doing something crazy. Like, I don't need to.
Yeah. So I think this was the first year in ages I went to a party, but it was a very low key party. It was kind of a small group of people at a party that was quite nice. So it wasn't that like intense having to dance and get really drunk type thing. It was just, you know, hang out and chat with some friends, some good friends. And that was really good. All right. Well, should we get into the discussion?
Let's do it.
Well, at the end of our year in review episode last year, our last episode of the year, Benjamin finished with probably the quote of the podcast, I reckon. Talking about identity politics, Ben said, "We've just got to get past it because I cannot see any of this changing while we are so hamstrung by this bullshit."
So we were kind of thinking about that episode quite a bit afterwards and realized that while we talk about identity politics all the time on the podcast, you know, it's a bit like things like, I don't know, neoliberalism, where we probably don't sit down and we use the word all the time. We probably don't sit down and have a proper conversation about what it is and why we're so keen on critiquing it.
So we thought today, starting off the new year, we thought for the benefit of ourselves and for you, our listeners, we thought that's what we'd do today. We want to step back and ask some of the big questions that sort of define this show in many ways. You know, what is identity politics? Where did it come from? What don't we like about it? And what can be done differently? So Ben, to start us off, you know, you get the big question to get us going. Can you give us a bit of a summary as to what identity politics means to you, and maybe to build from that, why you're so critical of it?
So I'm going to cheat a little bit here. Simon worded me up that this would be the first question, and you know, because it's terrifying, I've gone back to an article that he and I wrote last year for Overland about, it was kind of a response to an article that another writer had written in Crikey, a publication called Crikey. So it's, you know, it's we'll probably link to the article in the show notes, but of relevance is that it includes a basic description of identity politics. And so, you know, basically what it is on a very basic level is a philosophy and practice of building political movements around identities. So that might be, you know, sexual identities, gender identities, race, age, disability status. There's, you know, I'm sure people can imagine all the different kinds of identities that are covered by that. I mean, that's pretty much it in its most basic sense. So using those identities as a kind of starting point for political action and political movement. I would say that as part of that, as we said in this article, there's an implied kind of essentialism to identity politics that by sort of defining yourself in terms of an identity, it is, you know, saying that that thing is sort of, you know, that what I would say is a kind of abstract category in a lot of ways is inherently a part of you and somehow essentially a part of you rather than socially constructed or mutable or, you know, changing or performed or, you know, any of those sort of more kind of fluid ways of thinking about behaving and being. So I guess that's that would be my description in terms of actually before I get into you know some basic sort of criticisms of it, I'd be curious to just hear a response from you on that sort of basic definition.
Well, it's funny to ask for a response to that, given it's an article we both wrote.
Yes.
So, you know, obviously, yeah, look, I agree with that basic definition. I think we discussed this briefly before we started recording. It is a very narrow definition. It's I was just looking back at the article as well, and it's sort of confined to one paragraph, which is sort of very difficult to describe this in one paragraph. I think that the focus on the political movements around identities based on things like race, gender, sexuality, age, disability status, etc., is the key part of that picture.
Yes, yes.
But I think that, and maybe this is the discussion we'll go into a little bit later, I think that that also has particular elements to it, and it's and we're going to go into whether this means, you know, whether critiques of identity politics means giving up on movements that are based around these sorts of identity factors. And I think that I think it's going to be worth talking about some of the differences between material realities versus identity, sort of self-identification, which I think is a key part of my criticism of identity politics. And that is a little bit further for the, you know, sort of being able to recognise that, you know, oppression based on these sorts of identity factors is definitely real, whilst also being able to critique the approaches, the responses to that is something that I think we'll need to do.
Totally.
That, so
totally.
That goes a little bit later in the discussion, I think. But I'd be intrigued. You know, I agree with your. With your broad definition, and I think we should maybe sort of start with the critique as a way to maybe dive into this a little bit more.
Totally, because it's not a... whilst I would, you know, stand by that as a definition, it's not particularly illustrative in that it doesn't really imply directly a lot of the problems that come up around identity politics.
Exactly,
I guess, yep. Thinking about what my kind of basic critiques are, I think I could broadly say that I have theoretical critiques and kind of critiques in practice.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we'll... I won't get into the practical critiques just yet, because I feel like that's going to end up being the bulk of the discussion.
Yep.
But even at a theoretical level, I would say one of the core critiques I have of identity politics is that it's fundamentally conservative, that it lacks, I guess, transformative power. So, mm-hmm. So what I was saying before about it not really engaging with, deconstructed ways of thinking about sort of being and doing around sort of the performance of identity and things like that. I don't think really has the capacity to, it sort of codifies identity rather than provide space for it to possibly sort of grow and change. And, you know, it's about sort of identifying existing ways of being and, building political frameworks around those rather than arguing for any sort of transformation of being. So I guess in that sense, it's oppositional to a kind of liberation politics, which is all about, transforming the community and society through the transformation of the self. And I guess the biggest implication of that is that under the terms of that, nothing actually has to change. Like the goal of movements that often come out of identity politics become about diversity and recognition. And nothing actually has to materially change for those goals to be achieved, because they're it's just about recognizing existing identities.
Yes, I 100% agree with you on that, and I think that where the definition we spoke about as the implied essentialism to identity politics is really key. There is an assumption within identity politics that I think, as we said, you sort of become defined by what you are rather than what you do. But also a key element of that is that what you are is sort of an inherent part of yourself. It's not something that it's the classic "you're born this way" mantra that really gets played out in a lot of identity politics. And but integral to that is that there is no critique or no discussion about how particular identities have been formed and shaped, or how particular subgroups or groupings of people, how have been formed over time, and what that actually means. So, for example, the perfect example I have of this is something that, I read about a lot, is that even the very idea of there being a homosexual, the term homosexual, is something that's very new. It's only something that's existed for 120, 130 years. Same with the term heterosexual. These are terms that are very new to our understanding as a society.
It's important to say not just terms, but concepts.
The concepts, you're right. Sorry, the concepts, the very concept of themselves are very new, and have been developed for particular reasons in particular ways that have been benefited, particular power structures. But identity politics doesn't analyze that. It doesn't critique that. It just sees the identities as they currently exist as sort of being inherent, as being essentialized, and therefore something that we need to protect. And in doing so, if you provide critiques to that, you end up becoming becoming the evil bigot. You know, you, if you're the person who does this, you're sort of the person who is denying the right for somebody to be that identity, which is, you know, sort of, for me, just lacks sort of some substantive critical analysis that, you know, you can't, it's a hard line to, it's a sort of hard line to, sometimes fine line to walk along, but, you know, we had to critique some of these groupings and the way that identities are shaped, but identity politics
totally
doesn't allow that to occur because
it's so essentialized. I would say, because I can kind of hear an imaginary chorus of listeners kind of going, you know, and kind of having some issues here, and I think it's worth kind of saying here, and I think this is going to come up a lot, so you know, we'll try to be explicit about it, but I suppose take this as a, to some degree, blanket acknowledgement of this as a sort of... problem with analyzing this stuff, but I feel like a lot of what you're talking about is arguably, well, and this for me is sort of the question at the heart of all this. It could certainly be argued that these things are not inherent to identity politics, that in practice they are usually a part of movements based on identity politics, but, you know, if we take that sort of basic definition that it is simply a way of political a form of political organizing that is using identity as a starting point, then there's no reason really why, well, not no reason, but, you know, hypothetically, the kind of criticisms that you're making don't necessarily, you know, they're not inherent to that idea, I think. It's more that... I mean, I would say that way of thinking about identity, I mean, God, even identity just becomes this sort of meaningless word when you're talking about it like this, but even that way of thinking about politics very quickly leads to the sorts of things that you're talking about. So I think that sort of analytical distinction is probably quite important to make.
Yeah, it's the kind of... you know, in theory, what could this look like? Yeah, what could identity politics look like? Doesn't have to involve these sorts of elements. In practice, that's not the reality. And so there's the difference between the theoretical discussion and the what occurs in reality. And I think the theoretical discussion is important to have, but we also have to recognize that this is a type of politics that occurs in a reality. That's sort of where the basis of our critique comes from.
Yeah, I mean, I think that actually a really good way to get at that is the question, you know, if we were to sort of play devil's advocate here for a second, I mean, it's funny because I feel like we're always playing devil's advocate, so it's like devil's advocate to our own devil's advocate, and think about what we might say is, if we were to argue for identity politics, what might we say is good about it? Can you have a crack at that?
Well, look, I think at the basic level, you know, and to start off, if we go back to our original definition, I think, you know, understanding that there are oppressions focused around things like race, gender, sexuality, sex, age, disability status, et cetera, I think that the recognition of those oppressions was and remains really important, and I think that is something that we can't deny, that the civil rights movements and queer movements and feminist movements are all extremely important. And I hope, you know, I don't want to deny that as part of this podcast. I don't think that is something we want to do, clearly, given that we have an episode, a podcast called Queers. And so that's really important, that this is not saying that, you know, what we should do. And a lot of the sort of reactive ways of dealing with identity politics is say, well, we should just not talk about these issues. We just talk about class or only about class or only about economic issues, because all of these minor identity politics issues are not valuable, or, you know, or they don't help, you know, in some particular ways, you know. And a lot of the reaction to, you know, to a lot of the political events last year, that's been a lot of the reaction to that. So I think that is really important. I think that also, you know, I think that playing devil's advocate, there could be a lot to say about the capacity to for identity politics to break particular social norms or particular identity norms, I guess, to be able to say, look, when you see this proliferation of gender identities, for example, or sexual identities that is occurring in our modern world, it was Facebook who last year released all of the, I can't remember exactly how many different ways to identify, 50 different ways to identify your gender on Facebook. You know, and that what that can do, what one could argue, is actually end up breaking down a whole bunch of these really restrictive norms around gender and sexuality, and that is a really valuable thing to occur, and that people are able to step back and say, well, this is what I want to be, and that sort of individualized process may end up breaking down sort of social expectations. I would have a critique of that, but I think that is sort of some of the clear pros around identity politics, or some of the clear arguments for it, that it sort of allows people to be who they want to be, and promotes that, yes, really strongly.
Although with the rhetoric, it allows people to be who they are. Which is obviously an important distinction. Yeah, I mean, and I think what you've identified is kind of both, the same thing is sort of both identity politics' strength and its weakness, which is that it's super easy. Like it basically allows people to engage in a kind of ethical framework that's just about essentially learning a set of rules about how to recognize diversity and acknowledge diversity. And so I think it becomes quite a, like, at a basic level, an easy way for people to feel like they're doing something good. And I think, that's not to say that there's no good as a part of that. I think there is. But, the flip side of that is that because it's easy, it's also just incredibly limited in that the kinds of things that you identified that it achieves, I think that's right. It's just that that's probably all you can do with it.
Yeah, and I think it's actually really interesting to say it's super easy, because I think you're right in that it's super easy for two different groups. So it's easy in many ways for people who... maybe some people would disagree with this, but the way that you would be seen, it's easy for people who want to identify in different kinds of ways, in that it gives space for people to do that. And I think that there's a real positive to that. But I think it's also an easy way, or seen as an easy way, to deal with oppression, that if you want to be someone who's an ally, or who doesn't, or someone who's fighting oppression, I guess, of people of minority groups, then the things you need to do is, make sure you use proper pronouns, and don't say homophobic comments, and don't use racial stereotypes, that kind of stuff. Allow people to be who they are, rather than actually engaging with some of the structural elements behind these oppressions. So you're sort of dealing with oppression on a very, in my opinion, on a very superficial level, on a very skin based level. I don't know what that term is, but very superficial level, rather than actually looking more in depth as to where these oppressions have come from. So you can talk about, there's a lot of focus, I think, in identity politics in particular, on language and the types of language people use as a way of solving oppression, rather than going into some of that more material realities of what oppression is based upon.
I mean, and it's been, this is something that's just been beaten to death, really, but the safety pin box, it's just like the kind of perfect example of this. It was a couple of African-American women in the US put together this, it's basically like a monthly subscription service where a white ally can order like a box that's full of like instructions for things that they need to do to be a good ally, basically. And it's supposed to be about, I guess those actions having positive outcomes, but also that the money goes to supporting, the founders of this thing to do other things. And it's just like, it's literally, buying a list of things to absolve you of kind of guilt.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this actually goes into the other big criticism of identity politics that I have that I would like to dive into. And that is that it's very individualized. And it's a very individualized approach to dealing with particular social oppressions. And it's individualized in two different ways. Firstly, it's individualized in the sense of the way that people of particular groups can be liberated from oppression is just by being able to be who they are. So being able to have that space to be able to identify as they are, I guess, as they inherently are,
Sure.
and to be able to do that. But then also it's individualized in the sense that the way that we solve oppression is for individual people to make sure that they are give people that space. So that individual people make sure they use the right, going back to that list I used said before, make sure they use the right pronouns and don't use homophobic language and all of that sort of stuff. And what occurs in the outcome of that is that the focus of identity politics, and I would notice this quite regularly, is that the focus of identity politics is on often ends up being the rage of identity politics, I guess, is often ends up being on particular individuals who don't follow those particular rules. So the high profile person who says the sexist thing or the transphobic comment
Sure,
or makes the homophobic comment. So it's focused
this
on
is
those
call-out culture that
individuals.
we've talked about.
Yeah, the call out culture, and that is a real inherent part of this, in that instead of, for me, I go back to the sort of, looking at the instead of looking at structural issues around why oppressions occur, we blame the individual because it's a very individualized approach to oppression.
I mean, I suppose I just to go back briefly to potentially positive things about identity politics, because I feel like this will offer some counterpoints to the individualism of it. Or one of them will, because for me, what the strength of it really is as a impetus for political organizing, in that it's been hugely successful both now and for decades as just a way to politically organize, to bring a bunch of people together for some sort of common goal. And whilst that can quickly devolve into the sorts of stuff that we're talking about, on a basic level, as we've talked about, I mean, think things like, and particularly when engaging with mainstream political systems, things like LGBTI have been incredibly helpful as ways to just engage with sort of some political change, and to make people feel a part of that change. So I think that's one thing. And I guess, like, secondary to that, I would say that it also has the capacity to just make people feel good, which sort of can't be underestimated, in that a lot of people, or who have what we might say are sort of marginalized identities, have maybe experienced, a lot of trauma or blah 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 blah, and pride can be something that can come out of movements based on identity as well.
Yes, I think those are two really good points. And actually, I think what they the question that they lead me to is can we, so I said before, I don't think that we have to this isn't about getting rid of movements around things like race or gender or sexuality or
Sure.
sex, and that actually, those things have had huge impacts. The impact of the decriminalization of homosexuality cannot be underestimated. The impact of the civil rights movement in the United States cannot be underestimated. As with the same of, Black Lives Matter at this point of time. But can we have a type of politics that engages with these sorts of questions of questions about oppression around race and gender and sexuality, etc., 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 that doesn't devolve into identity politics or the types of criticisms that we've made so far? Or are they inherent to having that discussion, to having those sort of political movements? Or are there other ways that we can do things that can still engage with this particular with these particular issues without sort of becoming really identity focused? What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, this will surprise no one, I'm sure, but the obvious answer that I'm sure both of us would have is a focus on sort of class issues and economic issues. I think I would almost like flip around what you said and say, given how embedded identity politics is and how much it just dominates, you know, quote unquote, left-wing political movements, I feel like it's, the question for me is almost more, how can we incorporate things like material inequality, economic inequality, into the kinds of identity politics based, identity-based political movements that certainly seem to be here to stay.
Yeah, well, and I think that that's actually the real challenge. And I think that it's one of these interesting things where identity politics, one of its, I guess maybe one of its benefits are that it manages to bring people across class lines into some sort of collective action. So you have wealthy queers and poorer queers fighting for same-sex marriage, for example, or at least maybe even if having some sort of collective identity potentially, even given their differences. And I think that that's not problematic. I think there's obviously clear problems around that.
Those movements, and marriage equality is a perfect example of a movement which tends, you know, ideally it would create the divide, cross those class divides, but in practice, the wealthy just end up controlling the movement for their own ends.
Yes, exactly, and I think that. But I think that that's what I was trying to get. What I was going to get to is that it's an interesting one in which identity politics, in ways, brings people across those class divides. In some particular ways, but at the same time, that creates these inherent problems in which you have situations where movements, are said to be, marriage equality is the most important issue of this, the last 10 years or so, but it is one that benefits the wealthy people in those identity groups a lot more than it benefits those poorer people. But I think that what I was trying to get at is that I think there is an inherent difficulty in bringing in class politics to this form of identity politics in many ways, given the fact that there is such a cross, such a diverse grouping of people along class lines within these sorts of movements. And what actually, in many ways, is more valuable to me is to be able to re-identify class as a major issue, and then to do that across identity groupings rather than within identity groupings. So to be able to say, actually, the struggles of women and the struggles of poor women and poor queers and poor Black people and poor Indigenous people, poor people with disabilities, are actually much more common than the struggles of poor queers and rich queers in many ways. And I think that is sort of bringing class back at that level is actually what needs to occur, or at least having that discussion that brings class back at that level to understand that, class, that's where class lies. There are different class interests within queer groups, for example, within queer people. And it's going to be hard to bring class into that debate when there are such different class issues in those groups. And that building alliances across groups may actually be more valuable.
Sure. I mean, I want to ask the really sort of obvious question here, which I don't feel like we've addressed directly, and it's probably important to do so. Why would you argue that? So that statement you made before about there are probably more commonalities between poor XYZ people than there are between rich and poor queers. How would you argue for that? Because I feel like that I just have a, I feel like there's a basic question here around, like, why do we think class is important or more important than identity as a basis for political organizing?
Oh, so that's a big question.
But it's kind of key,
it's
you know.
Isn't it? Yeah. It's essential. Look, I think that there's an important material reality to class that just can't be underestimated. And I'll be really clear. Like, class in many ways is the defining power structure that exists in our capitalist society. I mean, capitalism is based on class, and that the existence of class is really integral to ensuring the system survives, but also that means that it's integral to ensuring It's integral to ensuring the system survives, and therefore what that means is that you have an inherent amount of pressure that must occur in a class-based system. And that has real material impacts, in which you have situations where there are people who are living a high life when there are people who are struggling to get food day by day. Now, I want to say very clearly that there are people who are queer who are in that same situation, or the people who are women, obviously, people who are people of colour in that same situation. And it is often the queers, the women, people of colour, who are the ones who are in those poorer situations, or people who are in those lower classes. So there's obviously, and this is where it gets complex, in that there's obviously some crossover in which, you know, your identity has an impact on your class status, basically. And that's kind of important. That's where this gets a bit difficult, because you can't sort of discount identity entirely. And some try to do that. Some try to say, well, you know, identity doesn't matter. Class is the only thing that matters. But I don't fully agree with that, because I think clearly identity has an impact on your class status. There are particular historical reasons for that, in the sense that, for example, queers in, you know, if you look at the history, queers are people who have been seen as sort of dangerous to a capitalist system, because they don't fit to a general family mold, which is sort of seen as an important structure within capitalism. You know, women end up in that situation because, historically, largely because they end up primarily in the home to look after children, and that is a situation in which they're not earning as much as men, so that's why they often end up in a lower class situation. People with disability, same situation, in which they end up in that situation because they can't earn as much often because of potentially lower capacity to work, you know, in the standard capitalist model of work. So people end up in these situations, but class is the thing that still, in my view, is the underlying integral part of a system of oppression that exists in capitalism, and that's why it's more important. It is the central oppression. These other oppressions still clearly exist, but they're often related more to class than class is to those oppressions, if that makes sense.
And I think when we talk about the intersection between class and identity, it's also worth, like, identity is such a shit word. I feel like it's really difficult to talk about, because it just has become so... we just talk about it so freely and don't really deconstruct it at all, in the same way we talk about community, for example. But I think it's worth saying that, like, whilst I don't really believe in a sort of essential inherent identity, I think that it can feel like there is one, but, you know, I think absolutely. It's a sort of problematic concept in a lot of ways. Identity as a kind of grouping still has material realities, because society is structured around perceptions of identity in a lot of ways. So it has those kind of material outcomes. I think that's a kind of important distinction to make as well.
Yeah, no, I think that's really important. And I think that there are also material realities to identity as well. So, you know, there are material realities to class in terms of your status as someone with basically fewer resources than somebody else, or more resources than somebody else. There are, you know, and this is contested in particular areas, and there's lots of blurred lines in this, and I want to acknowledge that. But there are material realities to a particular identities as well. You know, there are material realities to being a person of colour, as, you know, the colour of your skin is that material reality. There's material realities to sex oppression, which is focused around, you know, people's particular bodies, and there's material realities around sexuality, which is the people that you fuck, which is the sort of basis of that oppression, and that material reality is again something that I think is not spoken about as in an identity politics, because instead it's sort of this inherent, we're sort of spoken about as in this inherent part of who you are, but it's sort of more about your sort of, I don't know, it's about who you are in your mind, not necessarily the things that you do, or the physical things that you are in many ways.
Well, it's not really, I feel like it's not really deconstructed at all.
Yeah, exactly. But that's, you know, and I think that that's an important thing is to note as well.
This episode's been going on for quite a while, and we probably should finish. I feel like this is just something, I feel like we could just talk a lot more about this.
I think it is.
Because the there's some stuff that we were kind of hoping to get into that we haven't really had a chance to, and I do think we should finish, but we might even think about returning to this, you know, with a kind of different sort of angle or a more specific angle. Yeah, let's have
yeah,
a
I think
about
idea.
That.
Yeah, I was just looking back at the notes that we took, and I think there's a lot more we could discuss on this.
Yeah, totally. We'll have a think about that. Were you, but, you know, was there anything that you wanted to add finally to this discussion?
No, I actually think this was valuable, though. I think it was good to be able to actually talk this out. I found it particularly valuable, and I hope our listeners have too.
Totally. And, you know, I hope, you know, we are certainly try very hard to be, to the extent that it's possible, self-aware and self-critiquing of our positions on class and against identity. So I hope this has been a good opportunity for us to defend ourselves. And I would really encourage people to get in touch with us. I mean, Twitter's probably the easiest way. We'll give the details for that in a moment, as we always do. But to really, you know, put the thumb screws to us if there are things that you are unsure about or disagree with, because I think it's important that we're able to defend ourselves.
Yeah, and I think that actually it's particularly important in this particular moment, because following the political events of the last year, this is a debate, you know, I was just doing some searching before we started, and this is really a debate that's really heating up. And a lot of people, for example, have blamed identity politics on the loss of Hillary Clinton to Donald Trump. A lot of people have blamed identity politics on the Brexit vote last year. And I think a lot of that debate has been quite narrow, has just said, you know, we should stop talking about gay people and stop talking about women and should only talk about class. And I think that debate is important, but also has the capacity to head in a very different direction that I would not necessarily agree with either.
Totally. And I think that exactly what you're describing is probably what I'd be keen to make the basis of another discussion about this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I think it would be worth having that discussion. And I'd like to hear from other people about their views on this, because I think it would be useful to build into this discussion.
Hmm. Well, that's it for us today, I guess. Thank you for listening. And we will be back in a couple of weeks with another episode.
In the meantime, you can catch us all our past episodes on queers.podomatic.com, and please go and subscribe to us on iTunes. And as we say every episode, please leave us a review and rating, which will help other people find us.
I am constantly finding out about people in my life who are very close to me who haven't reviewed and rated us on iTunes. Simon and I get very cross. I'm just like withholding friendship now, because I'm like, you've just got to do it.
Yeah,
so as I said before, you can find us on Twitter, and please do get in touch, particularly about this episode, because I think it's an important one to have more perspectives on. I'm at Ben C. Riley.
And I'm at Simon Copland, and you can also catch me on Facebook at Simon Copland Writer.
That's it for us today. We will see you all next time.
I'm looking forward to it.